I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In towns and cities across the country, there are stories of kids filling plastic bags full of coins or standing in the rain to sell hot chocolate to raise money for the victims of the Asian tsunami. Even veterans of the aid business say they're surprised by the scale of the response, the money that's been raised, and the number of people who continue to make contributions. Aid agencies now have to juggle what money gets spent right away, what's to be saved for later reconstruction, and what to do about all the other people across the globe living in war zones, struggling to survive in other nations that are not in the news and not necessarily getting help. How do you see the picture? Have you been inspired to give? If so, why? And beyond the desire to simply do something, is there a downside to disaster-related generosity? Does it have the potential to focus too much money in certain places and leave other areas without help? Or is it a welcome reaction to human need? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I have for the hour two aid experts here with me in the studio. Peter Walker is the director of the Feinstein International Famine Center at Tufts University. Peter, it's nice to have you here.
Morning, Dick.
And Mike Delaney is director of humanitarian response for Oxfam America. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
We're going to start, though, today with the latest from Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo. Ted Shaben is there, and he's working with UNICEF. He's joining us live. So it's already late in the evening, Ted. Tell me what you've been doing. You were out in the field yesterday, I understand?
Yes, I traveled to the north of the country, the town of Mulativu, which has been completely destroyed by the tsunami. And two days ago, I was in Batticaloa, Ampara, which are in the east, and then traveled to Matare, which is in the south of the country. So I've pretty much seen most of the areas that were affected by the tsunami.
Now, a place like Batticaloa, for example, is a reasonable-sized town, but it's built right on the coast. What is it like there now? Are there aid distribution systems in place?
There are. If I can first describe and perhaps visualize the destruction, I mean, essentially what you have is a band of territory, which is about 2 kilometers long, where you have all the houses on the seafront, and if it's fishermen houses completely flattened, if it's middle-class houses, some of them are still standing, but mostly destroyed, completely flattened by the wave, and the population that has survived has retreated into the inside and is in displaced camps, usually in schools, in temples, in different places, about 2,000 to 3,000 in each of the camps. And aid is reaching those people. The most urgent needs in terms of shelter and food have gotten there in probably sufficient quantities. I think the big challenge right now is sanitation, getting enough latrines and ensuring that there is no disease outbreak due to sanitary condition. So in terms of survival needs and stabilizing the situation, those are the most urgent requirement, and the challenge right now is sanitation.
Do you have what you need to do the work that needs doing?
We certainly have, thanks to enormously generous contributions, both from individual who are contributing, governments internationally, as well as a very good national response. I mean, there's been a combination of the private sector, different NGOs, and the government who have reacted here in Sri Lanka. So there are a significant amount of resources available. I think the challenge really is to get the resource into the right people, so there's a logistical challenge, and there is and will continue to be a coordination challenge. The government has set up a national center for operations, which is seeking to coordinate the different responses sectorally and act as an information clearinghouse at the national level. At the district level, there are officials called government agents that represent the authorities and, again, organize district coordination meetings. So there are different ways that this aid is being coordinated. This is a country with a reasonably good infrastructure, some of which has not been affected, and therefore aid is getting through. But obviously we're on day 7 of quite a large-scale natural disaster, so it will take time to gear up.
Would you say, you've had a fair amount of experience in this area, Ted, would you say that there is anything distinctive about this emergency, something that makes it separate or different from others that you've experienced?
Well, I think two things. One is that you have enormous destruction in a specific band of territory, unlike, say, a famine in a place like Bahr Ghazal in Sudan or in the Horn, where a large area is affected in many ways equally. In this case, you've got a specific part of territory which is completely destroyed. And then behind it, there's a hinterland with resources and capacities which can help to the people from that part of the country. At the same time, I think we should not underestimate that in those parts that have been affected, the destruction has been very vast. I mean, for Sri Lanka, for example, a country which has 25 districts, 12 of those 25 districts have been seriously hit. Something like 70% of the coastline has been hit by the tsunami. So, you know, it's nonetheless significant. And I would say the other feature is that this is a natural disaster that has hit such a range of countries, from Indonesia all the way to Sri Lanka, the Maldives, and India. And so in terms of organizing the response internationally, it represents additional challenges.
And Ted, Peter Walker from Tufts University wants to jump in here.
Hi, Ted.
Hi.
Ted, you were talking about the temporary camps that have been set up. Could you say something about your expectations for them? We know from past disasters that camps often lead to secondary causes of death, particularly where you have poor water and sanitation supplies. What's your expectation for those camps?
Sure. A couple of points. One is we now have about 800,000 displaced, according to government statistics, and that's an order of magnitude. The expectation is that, you know, 30 to 40% of people in those camps probably have an extended family member or have a home to go to, but it's close to the water and they're afraid to go back. A good part of that population will go back, and you'll then end up with a core group which needs assistance on a medium term basis. Camp situations, as you point out, are not good situations because people are congregated, often without sufficient hygiene. And as I've said, the first order of priority is to get sufficient sanitation in place. However, we do have some things going for us in Sri Lanka. First, there are high immunization rates in the country, and this is a country that's done very well when it comes to immunization. So, for example, the risk of measles outbreak is not there. And second, there is this hinterland, which is still intact, and so there are resources there. The plans are to consolidate some of these camps for this remaining population, which won't have a place to go to or family to stay with, and begin the reconstruction of housing so that people can get home as quickly as possible. For UNICEF specifically, looking at children, there are a few priorities. First is getting children that are unaccompanied reunited with their families, and there's a process underway that UNICEF is supporting to identify those children and register them, trace their families, and arrange for those extended family members to take the children in or fostering arrangements. Second, provide psychosocial support. Even such simple things as play equipment really make a difference. Third is looking at peer counseling and just giving children an opportunity to talk about what has happened. And lastly, getting children back to school. Schools are an important way to give children the sense that of normalcy and getting back to being children again. So we are working with government, with the local authorities in the different parts of the country, including in the north, to get children back to school by the 20th of January, supplying school kits, putting some furniture together. Even if the school is in a temporary shed, it can get going and the children can get back to a sense of normalcy.
Ted, quick last question for you because we're coming up to a break here. But how long do you expect to be there? Later in this hour, we're going to be talking about, you know, the reconstruction, how long it can last and how long these aid efforts need the kind of funding. How long do you think that this kind of work is going to be underway, simply bringing people back up to the level from before the tidal waves?
Well, I think the relief phase is well underway, and I think we're going to soon stabilize the situation. We'll be very much into a rehabilitation phase where we start to basically give people immediate solutions to their needs, and I think that will take 3 to 6 months. I think the reconstruction process is longer. But, again, I think we're looking for Sri Lanka at least something in the vicinity of a 12 to 18 month process to really get going and do most of the work. I think there is an opportunity here, not only to get people to where they were before, as you said, but also to make things even better. And again, we have to remember this is a country that's had 20 years of conflict. Much of the population that was hit by the tsunami was already affected by the war. And so there's an opportunity to fix some of that as well and get people better services, access to a better life through this natural disaster, basically turning this disaster into an opportunity.
Ted, I know you're putting in long days, so I appreciate your staying up in the evening to join us on the program today.
Thank you.
Ted Chaban is a UNICEF representative based in Sri Lanka. He's been there for 2.5 years, and he is in charge of the UNICEF phase of the relief and reconstruction that's underway in that country. A reminder, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When we come back after our brief break, we're going to talk with Peter Walker, director of the Feinstein International Famine Center at Tufts University, and Mike Delaney, director of humanitarian response for Oxfam America, who is, as we speak, busy packing up his stuff for a trip off to Indonesia to work in one of the areas that has been hardest hit by the tidal waves. We'd like to hear from you on how you're watching this disaster, whether or not you've been inspired to give money, if so, why, and whether or not you think that there's any kind of danger in focusing too much attention on one part of the world and leaving other people in other parts of the world then without the resources they need. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. With me in the studio, Peter Walker, director of the Feinstein International Famine Center at Tufts University, has managed relief response to the famine in Sudan in the mid-80s, and with the International Federation of Red Cross, was involved in missions in Iran, Pakistan, the former Yugoslavia, and other countries. Michael Delaney is also here. He's director of humanitarian response for Oxfam America and has led Oxfam's response to emergencies in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, the El Salvador earthquake, and flooding in Mozambique, as well as other countries. And, Mike, I understand that Oxfam America has been getting a significant amount of money in the past week. Tell me what's the latest there.
We have received over $12 million in the past week, far surpassing any level of donation to the organization in its history.
Are you surprised by that?
I am. I think it's been a tremendous outpouring of generosity, and people are really touched. People really are searching for a way that they can help and reach out to the people of Asia.
Is it a scale of giving that's appropriate in your mind to the scale of the disaster that we're talking about?
Definitely it is. I think that the scale that we're seeing here, the numbers, the way it's spread out, the logistics are demanding this. And I think what Ted was pointing out in his observation is that we're starting working with a population that is poor to start. And so we're not just talking about rebuilding. We just don't want to rebuild where people were, but actually recreate and allow people to have the more opportunities in their life economically, politically, socially than they did before the tsunami hit.
Are we talking about putting up concrete brick houses that were made of light wood before, that kind of level of improvement?
Well, there's lots of learning that has taken place in terms of learning from other countries that have been involved in disaster preparedness and prevention measures. The case of Bangladesh setting up elevated schools and community homes that can withstand cyclones. Cuba has some great examples in terms of how a hurricane can go right through the islands and thousands of people will be killed in other islands in the Caribbean. It'll go over Cuba and maybe one or two people will die, and then it gets to Central America and again thousands again. So there are things that can be done in preparedness and prevention in a rehabilitation phase that can help people withstand further crisis and economic shocks and all different types of disasters.
I wonder, Peter, if this is what those giving money expect their money to be used for, that you know, places like Sri Lanka, places like the fishing villages of Aceh province in Indonesia need to have that kind of extra little bit of financial assistance. So, you know, should something like this happen again, we don't have the same scale of death.
I mean, my sense is that people give out of compassion to start with, and they also give because they trust the professionalism of agencies like Oxfam, like the Red Cross, like CARE. And those agencies are continually giving this twin message of immediate relief now. You've got to keep people alive. That's water, that's sanitation, shelter, food. But then asking the question, how can you make sure it doesn't happen again? And that's a whole range of things. There are examples, if we look next door, say, in Vietnam, where an early warning system is in place so that people know when a cyclone is coming or when a major flood's likely to come. They've developed housing techniques which are relatively cheap but allow houses to withstand cyclones. They've looked a bit further, and they've looked at how can they, as it were, tweak the local economy so that marketing systems can be reestablished quickly. Simple things like bridges that are more robust so people can market.
Let me ask Mike just about the money that has come in. There was a curious thing that happened, I think, late last week when people going to the Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders site, were being directed to Oxfam. Yeah. Is that right?
Yes.
What was that all about? That seemed like a curious sort of, no, we've got enough money, give it to somebody else.
Well, their basic philosophy is that they are first responders, and they are prepared to be there during the initial phase of the operation and the initial phase of the relief effort, so that by the time that they would withdraw, local institutions are reestablished, local hospitals are functioning, and then they would withdraw and be prepared for the next emergency.
But is it at that time when agencies like Oxfam are still in helping with the reconstruction? Is that what they were saying then?
Yeah, and so that the real need here and what we need to focus on is the level of livelihoods, the need for rehabilitation, improving people's livelihoods is going to be an extended period of time and an increased amount of investment. And so they wanted to say, okay, we have enough right now. Let's invest this in the future.
We're going to take our first call from Louisville, Kentucky. Felicia is joining us on the line from there. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for accepting my call. I think the first thing that struck me was the comment that why people aren't as apt to give money towards other disasters that are going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that struck me was that there's no historical context to a natural disaster. We don't have to worry about who's good, who's bad, whether the money we're giving is going to a world government or anyone who could use the money in a way that we don't want to be used. I think people see that natural disaster, something they understand. You know, over here we have tornadoes, we have hurricanes also, we have all types of natural disasters, and I think people can see that those people need help in that area, and they don't have to worry about any war, human rights issues. It's just easier to grasp, easier to understand for people.
Peter, talk to Felicia. Has she got something here?
Hi, Felicia. Yes, actually, if we look at the figures over the last 10 years, the average amount of giving to a victim of an earthquake is about 10 times that of the victim of a war or a victim of a famine.
You don't mean government aid. You mean people who open their wallets or write a check.
People open purses and the money that comes into agencies like Oxfam or CARE.
10 to 1.
About 10 to 1. And I think it's partly because, as you said, with an earthquake, your first thought is nobody's to blame. Everybody's a victim.
Right. And I think that's definitely it. I mean, you don't have to worry about anything other than the disaster happened. There needs help. There's no historical. You know, we don't know exactly what's going on in Sudan. We know there's genocide. You know, our United States government has said that. But do we really know what we can do to help?
How do you square, though, Felicia, the sort of basic understanding that the villager in Darfur has no better understanding of what, you know, caused their village to be attacked? They're likely no more to blame than the victim of an earthquake.
I guess it becomes incumbent on the quote-unquote first world nations to take it upon themselves to make sure that all victims of, no matter if it's human rights violations or natural disasters, get the help and money they need. I think that one of the things that we have to do is just keep with, along with, we said the two-prong effect, that people need help now, mm-hmm. and we need to make sure it doesn't happen in the future. I think the third thing is to keep everyone educated of all the issues.
Mike Delaney, how do you do that? How do you keep people's attention on something like this story 6 months from now? Or how do you get them interested in victims of a drought who may be suffering famine 8 months from now?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I think that we really need to look at this in terms of a learning opportunity as well. For instance, what was happening this time with the giving, I think there was a greater emphasis on cash donations, which we really have not seen in the past. Many times you would see a lot of community groups gathering cans and clothing and
right.
wanting to send that off. But there was a clear message that went out this time in terms of what the needs are, how to best gather the financial support and get it to victims in a timely fashion. I think by using this the focus on the people right now can be used as a learning opportunity and an educational opportunity to talk about these issues, to talk about need in other areas, the root causes of the issues around the world, and bring greater attention to places like Ethiopia, Sudan as well.
Peter, though, you've spoken before about a spotlight. As if there's only one. Now, the spotlight for a long time, I guess I'm talking about the media principally here, but, you know, was on Iraq. The spotlight is so directly now on the victims of the Indian Ocean tidal waves. Is there no room for two spotlights, three spotlights?
Well, I should have thought there'd be room for at least 50 spotlights, because that's at least how many major crises there are ongoing in the world at the moment that we call humanitarian crises. I mean, you spoke earlier about, is too much going to the Indian Ocean? Well, no, too much isn't going. The problem is that there isn't the same amount of attention on other areas. I think it's partly to do with what's media-led, what's the possibility of good television. I think it's also to do with people's sense of, is something achievable? You have a sense after a tsunami like this, you can make a difference, right?
Okay.
And, of course, your money does make a difference with a much more ongoing crisis. If we look at the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 3.3 million people killed in the last 5 years in that horrendous war that's going on there. Now, your sense of making a difference there, it's much more difficult to see how your money is going to make a difference. But that doesn't mean those victims are less deserving.
Let's go back to our phone lines if we can. Anne's joining us on the line from Boston. Hi, Anne.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I'm sitting here listening, and my thoughts are just running around in my head. First, I guess I'd like to thank the guests on your show for doing what many of us would like to be able to do but just practically can't. So I would like to say thank you to each and every one of them and all of the people they work with. But I guess as I was beginning to listen at the beginning of the show, I think there's this sort of twisted irony that on the one hand, we're, you know, destroying the country of Iraq through war, when on the other side, you know, not the other side of the world, but close by, a natural disaster is happening, which is essentially, you know, creating the same kind of destruction. And, you know, to agree with your first caller, I think that, you know, we as Americans want to give, and we, you know, many people don't want to make a political statement, and giving to a natural disaster, you don't need to do that. But at the same time, I think there are a lot of people who disagree with what's going on in Iraq and feel compelled to help in any way that we can, and so are quick to donate to the situation, you know, around the Indian Ocean and Taiwan. And so I guess I'm just sitting thinking that, you know, there's sort of twisted irony to what's going on in the world, and it's quite sad. You know, it's very disheartening.
Peter.
Thanks, Anne. And, you know, the basis of humanitarianism and the sort of work that Mike Delaney and Oxfam and the like do is all about people-to-people links. It's about people who have compassion and want to change the world doing something because they see families that could be their families in another country. So I think anybody who donates into one of these programs is part of the aid effort. It's not just the few people on the front. And I agree with you that the almost the juxtaposition of this disaster with the war in Iraq has struck in many people's minds a sense of the Iraq war brings pessimism, whereas the donation into the tsunami appeal gives you a sense of hope. The spending on the Iraq war, if I was just trying in my head to add up the figures, and I think that which has been pledged so far for the tsunami is about a little less than 1% of what's been spent
on
the Iraq war.
2 billion compared to some 200 billion for the war in Iraq.
So when we talk about too much money, we have to look at the bigger pictures, you know, compared with what?
I wonder, though, Mike, if people, I'm thinking of what Peter's saying here with people-to-people connections, that idea that your dollar is going to make a difference somewhere, and whether or not over time we have developed suspicion even of the level of sort of government aid. I was listening to a news conference that Kofi Annan was holding yesterday, and he drew a comparison to the earthquake in Bam, Iran, which was coincidentally exactly 1 year ago from the day of that. And the figure that he gave was that governments and organizations promised $1.1 billion in aid, and Iran reports that $17 million has arrived a year later, just a fraction of that. And I wonder if in your connection with donors, people feel like, boy, they've got to do it because maybe the politicians aren't going to come through.
That's a good point. I think in some ways, Oxfam America, as an organization that doesn't take government money, has a special obligation along those lines, really, to identify where the needs are and really urge the U.S. government to respond appropriately in certain areas. Mm-hmm. I think also the idea that in terms of Iraq, there might be this idea of a pent-up feeling that, you know, there was people have watched this develop over time, and really there may be a bit of helplessness in terms of watching this unfold and getting worse and worse, whereas this arrives
and feeling that they couldn't really do anything
exactly
about it, right?
And at this time, seeing that there are opportunities that people can connect on that personal level and help people in their time of need, as well as help them rebuild for the future.
This brings us, Peter, though, back to what Mike was saying earlier about it being something of a teachable moment, whether or not you can use the opportunity of this global scale disaster to change people's attitudes about how they give. I don't know whether or not that's possible or whether or not it's always going to be something that's so deep from the gut that it can't be taught or notions can't be relearned. What do you think?
I think you can change, and I think we are seeing changes already. I mean, Gandhi used to have this wonderful expression that compassion is not enough. It has to lead to commitment. You've got to do something with your compassion to change things. My sense is that people should be, in a sense, asking two questions. One, about how their government's spending money, because after all, it's our money. It's the money that's come from taxes. Is the money new money, or is it reallocated old money? Do those pledges actually turn into donations? And the history of every major disaster shows that there's a discrepancy between what's pledged and what actually arrives. So you need to hold your government to account, whether you're in America or Britain or Japan, over these sorts of things. Will the long-term money just be money that was already allocated for development and reprogrammed, or is it really going to be new? And then the second thing you've got to think about is, why were people so vulnerable in the first place? Why is it that the tsunami hit there? There's been a tsunami warning system in the Pacific for 40 years. The technology is old hat. You could do it in the Indian Ocean. The communities we heard in Sri Lanka, the poorest fishermen's houses wiped away, the middle-class houses a little bit better. So why is it that some people are more vulnerable to others, and how do you fix that?
Certainly there is evidence that even the poorest countries, Bangladesh among them, have been able to put in these kinds of early warning systems. So what's the expectation for some kind of long-term change as we assess the aftermath of the Indian Ocean tsunami? And what about the money that goes from there, both at the government level and out of your pocket? Is this a distinct moment in the world? Have you been as moved to give money for something like this before, and will it change your attitude about what your responsibility is? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about the aid money that is being raised for the victims and the families of the tidal waves in the Indian Ocean. Certainly, money has been raised at a scale that has not been seen by many people, even veterans of the aid agencies. We're taking a look at that and trying to measure it against some of the other parts of the world that don't get the attention that they should, what the difference is, how you see it. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Mike Delaney, Director of Humanitarian Response for Oxfam America, and Peter Walker, who is Director of the Feinstein International Famine Center at Tufts University. We're going to Leicester, Massachusetts for our next call. Peter's joining us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. What do you think?
Well, you know, you talk about spotlights, and I think we have an international spotlight called the Millennium Development Goals. And I would like to see this outpouring of generosity stimulate a discussion about the U.S., our government, living up to its pledge of 0.7% of its GNP to overseas development assistance that was made as far back as 1970. And I'd like to hear your guest's opinion on that.
And the connection between the commitment that is made at a government level and something like this, or just like...
I think, you know, the Millennium Development Goals, I think... there's a thing called the Millennium Project, which is run by Jeff Sachs at the Columbia University.
Right.
And they're about to present a plan to actually achieve these Millennium Development Goals. And the cost of that plan is well within the 0.7%. And I think that as a country, if we promised that, you know, as far back as 1970, I think now we're only giving 0.4% of our GNP. And I think that it's in our own best interest economically in all kinds of ways to live up to this. And, well, we have the spotlight of the tsunami. Millions of people die silently every year from things like bad water. Never make the headlines.
I wonder, Mike Delaney, when you're measuring the kinds of donations that Oxfam America will get over something like this against what Peter's describing in terms of these long-term grand plans, do you feel in any way like you're competing for the same dollars when you're doing this?
Do you mean competing between?
Well, I mean, you have people in this country who could turn their attention to the politicians and say, you know, more of our money ought to go to Millennium Development mm-hmm. Goals. Or you can have people in the country say, you know what, let's not bother with stuff like that. Let's just write the checks directly to MSF and to Oxfam and to CARE.
No, I think that in many ways that we feel that we can make a difference as Oxfam and CARE and in the humanitarian community in people's lives on a local level, influencing national level in the places we work. But it's also important, the government-to-government relationships that the aid that the United States government provides is an important level and at a level that's going to make a difference and provide the leadership of the types of development that is necessary. Our work in the humanitarian area would be greatly reduced if people's livelihoods were improved. Mm-hmm. If we were if the majority of people in the world were living out of poverty and not in the situation that we currently find them in, we would have less humanitarian emergencies.
Peter, if I'm not mistaken, the Millennium Development Goals aim to cut world poverty by half. Is that right? Is that one of the stated goals?
Yes, by 2015. And within that, there are many other goals that basically set targets for government and international systems to reach. And, you know, Peter, I think you've got an excellent point. The response to this tsunami should be about saving lives and then should be about saying, how can you rebuild in these countries in a way that makes people less vulnerable to disasters and builds into the Millennium Development Goals? So, for instance, you could commit to what's called retrofitting schools and hospitals. That's making them disaster-proof.
Yeah.
You could commit to a halving of the number of people killed in natural disasters per year by the year 2015. And it is about aid. The aid figures, the general public is very generous. But when we look at government figures, the government that gives most in the world to international development is Denmark, with just under 1% of its gross national income. I've got the tables in front of me for 2002, and I was looking down it. And although the United States, because of its size, gives most dollars, in percentage terms, it comes 22 on the scale, behind Greece, behind Spain, behind Canada, behind France.
I wonder, though, if we can make a distinction between the importance of giving based on the intellect and the importance of giving based on the heart, because what we're seeing now is obviously triggered by such a sense of compassion, Mike, for the people there. And I don't know how you translate that same sense of I've really got to do something on a compassionate need basis to I ought to be doing something on a regular basis.
Yeah, I think that's how that will be in terms of how we respond to this. I think that one of the important aspects of the humanitarian community is to be accountable to people in terms of their aid. And so that...
You mean the people who've given you the money.
Exactly. So that we show them how that money was used, how their money had made an impact, and then allow for this a continuing message, building in different reports to people throughout the stages. So it is a learning opportunity. You know, we have this event called a Hunger Banquet, which we do once a year in allowing people to come together in a church hall or a school, and randomly people come together for a meal, and 15% would get a gourmet meal. Another 15% would get beans and rice, and the rest would only get rice and be on the floor. Well, it brings a whole other level of feeling and education to a group that wants to help, and it connects them. And so I think that events like that, coming out of this conversation with the donors, with the humanitarian groups, will be important to educate around the root causes of poverty in the world.
I want to go back to our phone lines. We're going next to Columbia, South Carolina, and Tim's with us. Hi, Tim.
How you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
Okay, I just have one small question.
Yeah.
The money that we're giving to these countries, after they do the rebuilding, I wonder if they're going to unite in, like, Europe, or are they anyone there to protect them from Al-Qaeda? I mean, they seem to be wanting to destroy everything that the Americans have in touch with.
I'm not sure that I quite understand your question, Tim. Are you saying that who stays there in the long term?
Right.
And who makes sure that the housing continues to be improved, that the schools are rebuilt, that the money doesn't get directed off to the purchase of guns and that sort of thing?
Correct.
How do you do that, Peter?
Well, I think there are a number of things to put in place, Tim. Most of the aid agencies nowadays have extremely rigorous accounting systems. They have to be able to report back to their general public and to governments where they accept government donations and show against a budget they've produced exactly where the money has been spent. Original receipts have to come back. That's changed a lot in the last 15 years and really is pretty solid these days. You've also got to remember that this area of the Indian Ocean, I'm just totting it up in my mind, I think three, possibly four of these countries are affected by their own civil wars. So you have this disaster on top of that. They have a degree of economic unity. The ASEAN group of Asian countries covers many of these countries. Mm-hmm. I think what we will see is that the money certainly flowing through aid agencies in the United Nations is wisely spent. It's well spent. We don't track, unfortunately, money that's raised locally. I mean, we heard of the people in Sri Lanka who are making donations, and inevitably it's the local communities that always respond first in these disasters. One of the things that we hope to change over the next 10 years is the way we account for disaster spending to show that it's not all from the West. Many of it comes from countries that are affected in local communities. And if we really want to understand, if you like, the power of humanity, we've got to understand it globally.
I wonder, though, Mike, if it's in any way frustrating when you're in the business of providing aid for people. You were just recently in Sudan, I understand.
Yes.
Is that right? And we've been hearing reports from there that people ought to be paying a lot more attention to what's happening to the people who are losing their homes and the people who are, you know, victims of the fighting that's going on there. I'm sure you must have seen some of that while you were there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was, the numbers of people killed in the Sudan and the Darfur region has reached 70,000. There's about 2 million people displaced at this time. And, yeah, the situation there as well is very significant and in need of continued attention. I think that that is one of the points that Peter brought up, the idea that we wouldn't want governments, particularly the government, the U.S. government, to give up its attention to the situation in Sudan right now because of it's at a crucial moment for its future. And so I think that we need to play an important role in keeping those crises in an additional spotlight while we're responding to in Asia.
I guess I'm just wondering if it's frustrating for you to have seen that so recently, yeah, to be heading off to Indonesia, where, as we know, you wouldn't be in the business that you're in if you didn't, you know, care about people here and there. I'm not saying choosing one over the other, but whether or not it's frustrating knowing that here you're going to a place where there seems to be almost a surfeit of resources coming straight out of a place where people didn't have what they required.
Yeah. No, it is. It is a bit, I don't know if it's frustrating, but I do feel that there was a, we were also gearing up for a situation in Ethiopia in terms of a major drought that's there right now. And so one of my concerns was, will the people of Ethiopia get any attention or any aid at this time beyond what we have already in our banks to support them?
What do you do to try and raise people's awareness of that, Peter?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a dilemma that I'm sure that you wrestle with as well.
It is. In fact, we had a research team out in Sudan just a few months ago, and their report back basically says the economy of that area, it's cattle economy. And, you know, you need to pasture cattle, you need to transport them, you need to sell them. The cattle are now all in the wrong places. The pasture is being used up. The marketing systems are broken down. That means that already we know next year is going to be a disaster in the Sudan. And it is tremendously frustrating trying to keep people focused on many of the disasters. I mean, one of the problems is that internationally, there is no, as it were, funding in place for disaster response. It's all knee-jerk. It's like raising money to buy an ambulance after the road traffic accident has happened. I mean, it just doesn't make sense when we know we can predict 2/3 of the volume of disaster response every year. We know we're going to have to do this every year. We know roughly how many people die, you know, because you've got the statistics going back. And one of the real changes I think people are urging the United Nations to push for is that disaster response, like peacekeeping operations, should be funded on a pro rata basis, that basically governments contribute according to their wealth into the program, not according to a voluntary spirit after the event.
Let's go back to our callers, to Durham, North Carolina next. Cindy's on the line. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I wanted to comment on people trying to make decisions about where to give or how to give. In my neighborhood, we started a group we call the Giving Circle. And what we did was, it's about 15 people. We got together and we came up with a sort of a mission statement, I guess you'd say. We went through a few months of talking and surveying each other about what our values were and how to give. And what we decided right now is, and we've been going now for probably a couple years, but we pool our money. So each household gives, say, as little as $25 a month, but we put it together into one larger donation. We give locally now, but I think what helps me in this is that I feel good already about where I give some money each month to local concerns. And when other events happen, I don't have to feel confused about, do I give nationally or internationally? It kind of clears my mind a bit to be able to react to things like this, to say, well, I do have another, you know, $50 or so. I'm already giving to local organizations, and I can afford to do this.
Is it the idea, Cindy, that it is important to be making those contributions at a local level to kind of free you up to say, I don't have to be guilty about, you know, folks in my own neighborhood who might need something. I can make that extra contribution to someone on the other side of the world?
Yes, because I think even within our group, there are times when I feel like, gosh, you know, there's this pressing need here, and, you know, I'm giving to, you know, a local, you know, children's theater or something like that in an impoverished neighborhood. But I do think that what one of your speakers had said earlier that I think is so important is to get into some sort of spirit of giving regularly. And so you're already, in a sense, aware of some things going on. Like, I'm always aware. I hear things on local news, and I think, gosh, that would be a good organization for our group to consider. And then our group will nominate organizations, and then we research. And I think that people, this is our own personal giving circle, but people could operate different sorts. They're all over the country, actually. And it's just one way that I think people could feel good both about giving to an international organization now, but also supporting their community.
Peter, is this the sort of systemic approach to it, something that we're seeing more of in your judgment, the type of thing that Cindy's describing?
I think we are seeing more of it. And Cindy, what you're doing is, I think, the perfect way of organizing it. It is actually how almost all of the NGOs started. If you look at Oxfam's history, Save the Children Fund's history, they all started with individuals saying, we want to change things. And if you look in third world countries, you will find similar circles of people who get together and form small credit unions in their village, or circles in women's groups who will try and raise enough money so that between them they can improve a creche or can improve a school. And that's the basis of changing things, people getting together and saying, compassion is good, but we want to go further, we want to make a commitment, and we want to change the world.
And that also has an obligation for us as humanitarian organizations. The caller identified as the giving monthly provides that opportunity for that continued dialogue and conversation.
But
and
also for that long-term planning that we're saying, instead of it going exactly up and down like needles on a graph.
And also awareness. For instance, we have included a lot of our donors in issues on e-advocacy, for example, allowing people to do something other than just donate, but look at some of the root causes or some of the policy issues associated with poverty, and so that they can get involved in many different ways. I think that once giving on a regular basis happens, then there's an awareness being built up, and then further action and other possibilities arise.
Speaking of getting involved, you're on an airplane when? Tomorrow?
Yes.
On your way to Aceh in Indonesia.
That's right.
Good luck there. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Mike Delaney, Director of Humanitarian Response for Oxfam America. Peter Walker, it's been nice having you in the studio as well.
It'll be my pleasure.
Peter is Director of the Feinstein International Famine Center at Tufts University. Earlier in the program, we talked with Ted Shaban, who is UNICEF's representative in Sri Lanka. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.